Michael Roth is president of Wesleyan University. His new book is The Student, A Short History. It is an illuminating look of the student spanning from antiquity to Zoom. Roth narrates a vivid and dynamic history of students exploring some of the principal models for learning that have been developed in very different contexts from the 6th century to present day. Again, Michael Roth's new book is The Student, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael back to the roundtable this morning. Michael, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you back.
Very nice to be here, Joe.
Well, you're knee-deep into it now, right? Last time we talked to you, you were still enjoying summer.
That's right. We spent our summers in Monterey, Massachusetts, not too far from Albany, and we're in the woods, and there's a lake within walking distance. Very, very nice. And now we're back on campus. It's a beautiful day. I was just grabbing students as they walked by to remind them to register to vote for, you know, an Instagram post about the importance of voting. And, you know, that was following a lecture on forgiveness and the Republicans. And tonight there'll be a big debate watch party. So we're in the thick of it.
When you came back to campus, did it feel different than you left it in the spring of the year, which on many campuses was somewhat fraught?
Yeah, and here too. I mean, at the end of the school year, right before graduation, we just reached an agreement with people, students who were in an encampment on campus for about a few weeks. And that was fraught. I mean, it turned out fine, and there was no violence, and you know, there was a little bit of vandalism from other people, but that was stopped quickly. And nonetheless, there was a sense of tension around political disagreements leading to protests that could, you know, in many schools, were spiraling out of control. Not so here. Our students, although they felt passionately about the issues, they made sure to not get in the way of the regular business of the university beyond what we could tolerate anyway. Mm. We didn't go beyond what we could tolerate. And coming back, it was hard to know what the spirit would be. The first groups back are athletes and then international students. Those groups are less likely to be involved in protests than others. It's not entirely so, but mostly the case. And then first year students came, and I have to say they were as happy a group as I've seen coming in for their first year. This is my 18th year as president of Wesleyan. And this was a very jubilant, high energy group. And that has carried over into this now, our second week of the school year. So that tension is much reduced. I think a lot of people are waiting to see what happens with proposals for divestment and other things. But it seems that the energy on campus is being directed in a variety of ways, and I very much hope to directed toward participating in the elections to come.
I know when you were on the roundtable the last time, we talked about the summer and sort of a lull, if you will, and I asked a question that you said you were asked a lot, which is, you know, what do you expect in the fall? You just wrote an op-ed for the New York Times that said, I'm a college president and I hope my campus is even more political this year. How do you mean that, and what would you ultimately like to see?
Well, I was struck, Joe, over the summer by my conversations with different groups of presidents that many people were playing defense and worried about the potential for a student unrest in the fall. And I thought the bigger problem would be that if students didn't care about politics and, you know, their students are an important voting block, young people, a very important voting block, often underrepresented at the polls. So when I said I wanted our students to be more political, I didn't mean for them to chant more effectively or to have better banners, but I meant to go out and work for a candidate or work for an organization that's involved in the elections. And no matter what your political views, I think most people see this as a decisive year in American political history. And I think students, although they have every right to feel cynical They will not do themselves any favors if they don't get out there and participate. So when I wrote this piece for the Times, I really wanted to counteract this view that, reasonable academics want students to not be political. I think actually we should want our students to defend academic freedom. We want our students to work on the ideals of community they think are most appropriate for their town and their state and the country. We want our students to take their foreign policy ideas, if they're concerned about Gaza, and make their voices heard to people who are running for Congress, the Senate, and the White House. And so that was my argument in the Times, and that we want our students to be involved in the public sphere. We shouldn't want our students just to be worried about their grades or their internship or their starting salary.
So you have a line in the piece that says the last thing any university president should want is an apolitical campus. So how do you nurture a political campus?
Well, you talk about politics in the broadest sense, and you show students that there are opportunities to engage in meaningful activity in the public sphere. I can give you a few examples. We have students who've gone down to Georgia and are working for voter registration organizations, or people who are knocking on doors in Michigan, or here in Connecticut. I just ran into a couple of students from Maine, and it was very interesting. There's one gentleman who's wearing a crew t-shirt, and he was the look of an athlete. It's crew, these guys, big guy, And I said, yeah, have you registered? He said, I registered in my town in Maine, because that's a town that is likely to tilt to the right, and I want my vote to count in the other direction, he said. And so I'm going up there to cast my ballot and also to talk to people about their choices. And so one of the great things about what happens when you get involved in politics beyond the campus is that you talk to people who don't agree with you. On a campus, you're likely to run into a lot of people who say, oh yeah, that guy, he really is terrible, or But if you go and knocking on doors, you're going to find neighbors who are, they're your neighbors, they're your people you want to get along with, but they may have a very different view of taxes or of the school district or of foreign policy. And the first thing you learn to do, if you're good at this, the first thing you learn to do is to listen. And to listen hard and to find out, are there places where we could have a conversation that might be productive? Or you may say, hey, maybe this guy's right. Maybe I'm listening to someone who has a better idea. And so I say I want my students to be more political. I mean that I want them to be involved in the public sphere in a way that's educational for them. In this book, The Student, that just came out in paperback, I argued that students are really what they're practicing freedom when they're in college. They have a chance to try out different things in a relatively free sphere. And I think that this is a great gift we give our young people, and that they should test what they're learning by practicing freedom on campus. They should test that off campus. If you're trying to get somebody elected mayor of Middletown, Connecticut, where I am now, you've got to talk to a lot of different kinds of people. And you'll learn things from those people because, their concerns are real, their hopes are real, and sometimes the things they've suffered are things you should know about and perhaps be able to help with. So all those things make me feel like our campuses could be places of a deeper politics that creates a different kinds of community, not just a protest politics.
So give me a sense of how you believe there are some in your profession and higher profile, while higher profile protests were going on, there were college presidents who were asked if they had gone and met with those who were protesting, and they said no, and when asked why, they said they weren't invited. I'm just curious. So, how does that in your profession, and this is not you, obviously, but in your profession, how does that happen?
Oh, well, that's a great question, Joe. I'm the opposite extreme in an annoying way. I mean, when I was just out there asking people if they registered to vote, and somebody's actually filming me for a little Instagram post, I went up to some table and I see it's the Students for Justice in Palestine. And they don't want to be on camera with me. They know we disagree about divestment, for example. And I try to be respectful. I did ask them, do you want to talk? Do you want to have you registered to vote? And they made clear that they didn't want to play in my game right now. But during the time when there was an encampment, I walked through the encampment every day, a few times a day, and sometimes I would engage in conversation with people. Sometimes I would just wave to people, say hello. We're a small place. This is not a huge university. It's 3,000 students, and I wanted everyone to feel they could go anywhere on campus. Not that you would agree with people everywhere, but that you could move through the world without being encumbered by because of your identity or your political opinion. And so I think that people in my position should find ways, if they can, to meet with students who want to talk about issues. You don't want to meet with someone who's just going to throw a pie at you or punch you in the nose. I mean, I don't stick my neck out
No,
for
of
the heck of
course.
it. But I do think that you're much more likely to find a resolution if people know they can talk to you than if they think you're just some bureaucrat stuck in an office somewhere. And again, there were students who were very angry with me that Westlink is not divested, and the board will actually meet about this in the coming weeks. And I feel like they should know where I stand. I don't pretend not to have an opinion, but the fact that I stand in a place that's different from them doesn't mean we can't talk about this issue or about other issues.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University. His most recent book is The Student, A Short History, just out in paperback. You mentioned this a moment ago. And this is a history of the student spanning from antiquity to our current Zoom generation. What did you want to accomplish in looking in such a sweeping narrative at the student?
Well, I feel like I've got a good sense of college students. I've been a professor since 1983. I was 26 years old when I started teaching in the Claremont colleges, and so over time, I like many older people, I say, "Oh, the students have changed." Well, of course, I've changed a lot too, and so I was trying on the one hand to say, "Is there something in that students in my 30 plus years of teaching, really now 40 years of teaching, that is this thing that ties them together." And I'm a historian, Joe. I mean, all the books you mentioned and others I've written, they're all cultural history or intellectual history. And so I thought, how did it get this way? It's really a genealogy of the notion of the student. And I was interested in three models of learning that comes from the ancient world, a Confucian notion of following the master in a path, the Socratic notion of learning to be critical of people who believe they know what they really don't know, and then the Christian model through Jesus of imitating a life in a way that's transformative. And I was interested in how those three versions of being a teacher and being a student reverberate through the ages. And so I try very quickly, it's a short book, that to show that in the early pre-modern period in the West, students are really aiming to get economic independence and then integrate into a community. And then over time, I look at how some apprentices and how apprenticeships worked in the early modern period. And then I focus a lot on the modern period when the notion comes about that students should learn how to think for themselves in the company of others. It's a little bit of a paradox. You're not going to go alone into the top of the hill and think for yourself. You need to think for yourself with a teacher and then in the company of other students. And that is really the model we still have, I think, from the 1700s to our own day, of we want people to not just imitate their teacher's views, and at the same time, we want them not just to think for themselves in such a narrow way that nobody can understand them. So we want them to learn to stand on their own feet intellectually and be able to connect to other people socially, politically, emotionally. And I think that on college campuses, when it works well, that's what they're practicing, to to find figure out who they are in relation to other people, and to use their independent thinking to establish habits of learning.
What do you see the significance of a student being?
Well, a student is the, somebody might call it a liminal or transitional period. You know, they're not babies and they're not full-fledged adults. They're in a transition. And so part of what my book is about is how do thinkers in the West imagine that transition over a long period of time? And whether you're registered for school or not, if you're in that transition period where you're open to transformation, open to rethinking what you thought you knew, then you're in that condition of being a student. You know, I wrote a piece last year in the Times about being a perpetual student. You know, sometimes that's that was an insult, a guy who can't get a job, so he keeps enrolling in programs.
Right.
But of course, it's also a gift. If somebody who continues to learn, no matter how old they are, continues to be in transition, I think that those people are, for me, they're the most interesting people I know, are folks who continue to transform their lives through learning.
When you think of a student and what it means to you, and you talk about this in the book, which I want to just tap into for a moment, and it's an easy thing to say, but what is it, which is, what's a good student?
So I think these three models are so important. A good student, like in the Confucian time, learns how to be respectful in some ways of things that other people know. Because you don't really learn all that much all by yourself.
Right.
Second thing, though, is they learn to be critical of received opinion. They learn to be somewhat skeptical of things. And then the third thing is they're open to transformation. That a good student is someone who may think they know, let's say, I don't like jazz. They may say, I don't like jazz. I know that already. But a good student is someone who could put the headphones on and listen to, I don't know, Miles Davis and say, I see why people really love this stuff. And so in other words, they're open to change. They still may think I still prefer chamber music, or I still prefer rock and roll. But they're open their hearts, in this case, their ears, to something that they didn't think they were open to. So a good student is a person who can open their thinking and their emotions to something they didn't think they would be interested in. It's too easy to learn the stuff you know you're interested in. Like, and I open the newspaper, I try not to go to the sports page right away because I really want to find out like who won this game or how did Aaron Rodgers do last night, you know, or whatever it is. But I say, no, I have to read the other stuff first, because it's too easy just to follow your nose all the time or your interests. The good student is someone who is open to getting new interests, to opening new areas of inquiry and expression.
So this goes back to a question that I asked before, but in a slightly different manner of how do you foster that? So how, if a student comes in and is more closed to that, how do you pry them open like a clam and say, okay, this is a good way to go?
Another great question. You know, I think it's hard to put in a formula, but I see it happen all the time. I mean, I was very lucky as a young person to have incredibly gifted teachers. They were different from each other. Like one person who I had in philosophy named Viktor Gurevich, he was so hard. He was so tough, you know, and that worked for me because I wanted to prove myself to him. You know, I wanted to show that I could measure up. And I had another teacher, Henry Abeloff, who is a historian, who was the kindest guy, very gentle. And with him, it was more of an invitation to read kinds of books and consider kinds of ideas that I thought were I was above, or thought I'd already decided they were not interesting for me. The first one was intensely critical. The second one was kind of invitational. I find in my class, now I'm teaching a great books course called Virtue and Vice right now. And last week is Confucius, this week is Aristotle. And what I tell the students is, and they invariably say, well, Aristotle says that, you know, self-restraint is very important. And they'll say, I think he's wrong. So I have to tell them, you know, no one cares what you think of Aristotle. You shouldn't care what I think of Aristotle. What we want to do is tell me why Aristotle said what Aristotle said. And at first they're like, oh, because their parents have told them that their opinions count. And maybe their high school teachers told them that their opinions count. I tell them they don't count at all. What matters is that these are, we're going to at least pretend these are great books, great works of art. And we're going to try to understand why some people really find them incredibly powerful. And with that invitation to this group of students, you know, Wesleyan, they're very smart. They're capable of work. They do open up. And so, you know, just yesterday, Aristotle says, like Plato, that philosophy begins in wonder. So I have 100 kids in this class. It's hard to manage a discussion, but I had about 20 of them stand up. And I said, okay, what fills you with wonder? You know, it's the second week of school. They're a little shy in front of 100 people, but I don't care. I just like, okay, you. And I'm very, go very quickly through. And by the end, we have this little family of emotional responses to wonder, which leads someone else to bring in Greek philosophy and someone else to bring in Christianity and someone else. And they're like, you know, I have to say, okay, we have to move on. They right. are participating, not judging. And maybe that's it, Joe. To get them to participate and not just judge. You know, it's very easy to judge. You know, you get, oh, this is bad, this is good. But it's much more productive to participate and hang in there with the ideas to consider where they might lead you.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University. His most recent book is The Student, A Short History. It is just out in paperback from Yale University Press. Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us, and best of luck for the remainder of the semester.
Thanks, Joe. Look forward to seeing you back there in Albany before too long.
Be well. Thank you very much. Take care. Again, the name of the book is The Student, A Short History. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.